RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Ngāti Toa leader Helmut Modlik is chief executive of Te Runanga o Toa Rangatira. He debated the treaty, you might remember, opposite David Seymour on TVNZ not too long ago in October, and I think he got, the vote as the, winner of that debate. He and six other senior members of Ngāti Toa walked out of Parliament during the introduction of the Treaty Principles Bill. And, of course, the hikoi hit Wellington day before yesterday. So we thought we'd ask Helmut on to get his view, I guess a view from those opposing the Treaty Principles Bill and the support of the hikoi. Helmut, welcome to RCR. Kia ora, morena, all of that.
Kia ora. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for giving us some time. First of all, can I ask you, how does a Ngāti Toa leader have a name like Helmut Modlik, if you don't mind me asking, and maybe a quick explanation?
Great question. It's not the first time I've answered it.
I bet.
I am a Maori boy with a flash name. There's no doubt about that. So in the 50s, Sid Holland's national government hired an Austrian company, contracted an Austrian company to come out to New Zealand with 120 men. They bought their own wood, their own plans to build state houses. And here in Porirua, where Ngāti Toa is based, where I'm from, and so they came, and it was all part of the urbanisation movement or change after the war. And three of these squareheads, as my mother called them, three cousins from Takapuahia, and I'm the offspring of one of those, obviously. So that's how come I've got the best name. Yep.
And what home? Talking about Porirua, I know it well. I'm from Wellington. Huh? But home is Manaia. Is that right?
Oh, so my mum was born in Manaia, so my grandmother is from Taranaki, but my grandfather, my mum's father, is from Ngāti Toa, from Porirua. So that's where I was born and raised. Mum came from Manaia down to Porirua when she was a very little girl. So, you know, Porirua has been home for our people, for Ngāti Toa, at least for the last 200 years.
Okay. Here's a big question. New Zealand. A great country, do you think?
Great country. Best. I mean, I know the Americans say this stuff all the time, but you know, look, honestly, that's only because they don't know, haven't been to New Zealand. This is the best place in the world to live for a number of reasons. Love this place. Love our land.
What have we done right? I'm looking at the entire history, let's say. There are many places in the world way worse off than us. We're in the absolute top. Right. Yeah, what have we done right first? What have we done right to build this country, do you think?
Well, the first thing I will say is that from the Indigenous community's point of view, my ancestors came here nearly 1,000 years ago from the tropics. And when they arrived here, they did something interesting. Instead of changing the land they came to reflect where they'd come from, they changed themselves. And they learned how to live sustainably on this land. And so by the time contact was made in the late 18th, early 19th century, there was an established and existing society with its own economy, its own variety of elements of what societies are concerned with. And the initial contacts that were made with Europeans were, on the first instance, a matter of curiosity for both sides, no doubt, but they were by and large with a few exceptions when people got scared and carried away. But by and large, they were amicable and exploratory and positive. By the time we get to the 1830s, the British government of the day under King William, I think was the king at the time, they had learned through their long history of colonization lessons about what to do and what not to do. And so it's been a matter of real interest to me to discover that the instructions that came to Hobson from Lord Normanby, the Secretary of State and Colonies, to establish a positive relationship with the locals, with the sovereign tribes down here, to secure as much as he could, you know, a good relationship. That is the first big tick, I think, at the point of contact, that in fact, the establishment of the relationship, the formal relationship between the British at that time and the local Indigenous community, the Māori community, was an honourable attempt to coexist here. That's an important thought that is very rarely, if ever, understood. Now, the pressure that came from the settlers who'd been sold some porkies by the New Zealand company. They came here, they didn't find what they expected, and the pressure built. We then entered into the period where those initial commitments and intent didn't play out. Land was dispossessed illegitimately. There was military activity and so on. And so we get into the core, quote-unquote, colonial period. That's not a flash period. It lasted for, the rest of the 19th century and up into the, the first couple of three decades of the 20th century. That's not a good period for our nation in the sense of honourably keeping to those commitments made. On the positive side, the development of our society was operating in two streams. The Maori community, by and large, was rural and only marginally connected with the rest of, the English descendants that we hear in Scots and so on. The First World War, obviously, was a turning point for New Zealanders as a total, thinking about who we are as a nation. And I think what emerged out of that, that period of rugged, do it yourself.
Pioneer.
All of that mentality. Into the 20th century and our parents and grandparents' generations was a mix of values, that egalitarian idea, and we get into the 30s and the emergence of the welfare state and the ideas into public policy of fairness. There's a great deal that by the time we get to you, look a similar vintage to me, bro. By the time we're children,
we're about the same, I think.
Yeah,
you're 62. I'm pretty close.
By the time we're kids in the 60s, this is a pretty damn good place to live from a.
Well, that's how I remember it.
Well, it was from a social and
like a golden age, right? I don't know if it's just the rose tinted spectacles of time, but that's how it kind of felt.
There is a bit of the rose tinted, but by and large. Bro, I mean, it was a great place to live. I mean, our environment was still pristine. We could eat anything anywhere, swim anywhere, go into the bush. Great time to grow up. But there were some dark things happening as well, obviously. So, on one side, in terms of what was going on for the Maori community, after the war, the Second World War, after the war and urbanisation took place, and the workforce that was needed in the cities, and you had these large numbers of Maori people coming from the country, Pacifica people coming from the country, coming into places like Porirua, like Auckland, and so forth. Well, that discomforted the locals. I'm talking about the non-Maori locals, the Apaki community.
Yep.
And it gave rise to both public policy and social behaviours that, let's just call it, it was racist on occasion, and on occasion it was even worse than that.
But that's a legacy of the. Sorry to jump in, but that's a legacy of the colonial times,
yes,
isn't
indeed.
It? Because
yes, indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
The UK was probably the only power that could reasonably project this far in the world from its home base.
Oh, no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. I mean, just
They had a superiority complex. There's no question about that as well. But they probably thought they had a right to, given the times and the power and the emerging technology of the Industrial Revolution without going on.
All colonials thought that, Ewa. All the Europeans who had an imperial phase, whether it's the Spanish, the Portuguese, the French, the Germans, everyone of those societies thought they were the bee's knees and they projected themselves into the explorable or known world and did more or less similar things. So nothing new about that. But I do want to reiterate, though, that I am very respectful of what I have subsequently learned, recently learned, and had reiterated that there was honour, that there was good values in play. Now, they got overridden through the second half of the 1800s, the 19th century. I read an interesting autobiography, the Marquess of Salisbury. He was a prime minister at the end of the 19th century, and he came out here in the 1850s, and he expressed his disappointment at the caliber of men he found down here running the government. He called them, quote-unquote, a bunch of Auckland lawyers, and he was also a bit grumpy at what he saw as the behaviour of some of the settlers in respect of their militarism and so on. So there was a disquiet, shall we say, back in the home country with some of what was playing down here. But if we leap forward to the 50s and 60s, you know, my dad turns up here in 53. He's getting married. He says to his mates on the wharf, he's working on the wharf at that time, that he's going to marry a Maori girl. And they say to him, but play rugby with them, drink with them, but don't marry them. So that captures in a nutshell sort of like the, you know, the grassroots ambivalence at best, but racism at worst that was here. And of course, for the Maori community, having now endured roughly 100 years of, you know, lost resources, marginalization and disempowerment, it wasn't a great time, but at least it was a peaceful time. And then we get into the 70s when you and I were growing our hair long and starting to cause a bit of trouble.
Yeah, and listening to rock and roll. Well, it had come a bit on from rock and roll. Interesting what you say. In terms of where we've got to now, I want to get into all of that in just a moment. A point you made earlier about that shift from rural to urban.
Yeah.
In the decades that you mentioned.
Yeah.
I know this is all hypothetical thought experiment. If that didn't happen, if Maori stayed substantially rural and there was an economy and policy and thinking ahead of that to, well, not maintain it or force it on anyone because people could decide what they want to do.
Yeah.
But to enable that to continue, would we be living in a different kind of place right now?
Yes, we would. In a number of ways, and that is a very interesting question that I've not been asked. Here's my sense of it. So some key things happened when the Maori people came, when our Maori people came in large numbers from their rural home bases. They became disconnected culturally, emotionally, physically, obviously, from their roots, from their people, from their support base. And in the urban environment, struggled to really make that adjustment in some respects, that disconnection. On the other hand, what happened too with large numbers of Maori people coming into the cities, that's when we actually saw the policies start to come through that were that would eventually cause a great deal of the inequity. So, for example, the biggest one to my mind, or one of the big ones to my mind is, you know, I learned recently from, he's now Sir Kim Workman, that when he first tried to join the police in the early 60s, that Maori people couldn't actually join the police force. And that when large numbers of Maori people are accumulating in these communities, it was as a consequence of changes either in explicit law or law practice that the young people start getting picked up and taken into quote-unquote state care. And then, of course, we know what happened to those young people in that environment. And then out of that has come the broken souls, the gangs, and the extreme elements of harm. Now, at the same time, you know, when we're growing up, but education wasn't that big a thing for New Zealanders, right? Yeah, everyone could get a job anytime on the land and the factories, piece of cake. So, you know, school, kia ora for that, go get a job. Then, of course, our people come in large numbers to the city and their work is what? It's the, you know, it's the manual labor work. When society changes through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and there is an economic, you know, there is a separation in where the money is found, and you can't actually support your family on a low-educated labouring job anymore, and all of that happens, then we've got economic polarisation. Now, I could go on, but you get the picture, right? All of that adds up to creating pressure, in my mind, that gives rise to the to some degree to the inequity we see today, to some of the criminal stuff we see today, and the despair we see today. And I do think that question you asked, if our Maori people had stayed at home and in their tribal boundaries and had built their economies and their society and with all of the benefits of that co-location, yes, I agree. We'd have seen a different world today.
I think I get what you're saying, and I've spoken to others about it on this program who've expressed a similar thing, that maybe a lot of people who aren't Maori, and even some Maori, need to consider the connections that are there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
to, you know, the average hardworking kind of technocratic person out there in the, you know, so-called first world Western society, they're not so connected to those things. So they probably don't even give it a thought. Well, they might look at a landscape one day and go, oh, that's beautiful, but that's about it. So how important, I mean, I think I already know the answer to this, but I'll ask you anyway. The physical connection being broken is kind of like, what, a lifeline being broken, or an umbilical cord. I don't know what you call it.
Yeah, those are good metaphors. Those are good parallels. I mean, I would extend that to everybody, but so I would say, right, that in the not too far distant past, our parents' generation, and even our own early lifetimes, right, I was alluding to before, it's a true thing. When we're growing up, you walk to school, you get home, and you can't wait to go play with your mates, get into the bush, go swimming, go diving. This beautiful land, for the majority of its time, except its most recent decades, has been a paradise for the people who live here. And by and large, we've looked after it. But what's there is a great deal of well-being that has flowed to us as people and as a community and as a nation because of that relatively close to nature, close to community, villagey dynamic, and so forth.
Yeah, but when it defines you as a person.
Sorry?
Where you came, when it defines you as an actual person, where you came from.
Absolutely.
What all those coordinates actually mean. What those land features mean, the stories that people have put together to link them all together. The average person walking in the street these days never gives that a thought.
No, it's gone significantly for modern people, and that's a loss for all of us, for all of us.
All right, I want to get on to the most recent stuff in a moment. We talked a couple of times with Te Kura Ferris on this program, Te Pāti Māori, and, you know, he was giving his view of sovereignty back in the day. And you mentioned the word earlier too, sovereign
nations. I can't remember. Tribal nations in one sense.
Can that actually be defined as using the word sovereign?
No.
Can we?
Yeah. Well, depends on what you mean, right? So in 1835, with the support of some local British people, in the north of Aotearoa, some tribes supported to draft a document called Declaration of Independence, or Whakaputanga, that was then sent up to the King of England, who formally acknowledged it and his government. A flag was created in connection with it. And the purpose of that was to formally put a stake in the ground that the British could respond to, that the independent tribes in this land had, in the language of the English, sovereignty over their tribal areas. Now, the language, the Maori language that was used in that document, because, of course, that's the only language they had, was twofold. One was mana. So most people in these days have some sense of the idea of mana. And the other one was kingitanga, which was interesting. So that's obviously a transliteration of king. And tanga makes it the role and the power that a king has. So they were saying, in our worldview, we have the mana on our lands, and we also have, in your worldview, effectively the kingitanga, or sovereignty. So that was the language they used. And so, you know, pick your word, the idea of sovereignty is absolute, it's the superlative, right? There isn't anything higher in terms of authority in relation to a people or a place. And so in connection with the independent tribes of Aotearoa, those tribal groups and their leadership structure was the highest, all right, authority for those people. And
okay, so that's how you're defining it.
That's how I'm defining it. Yep.
Okay. Can I ask you a bit about mana, please? And I think, like you said, in general sense, I think I know what it is, but the nuances of it.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that there are nuances.
Yeah.
Is it, and I'm just going through words I can think of, it's not pride, right? Or it's an element of pride in it, but not, you know, over the top pride, because pride's not good.
Let me tell you directly.
Okay.
So in a traditional Maori worldview, all things, animate and inanimate, have a life essence or a life force, which is called a Modi. Now, in connection with human beings can have personal power, I'll use that word, which flows from their Modi and manifests itself in the mana of that person. Now, depending on the words and deeds of that person over the course of their life, their mana can increase or decrease. So their personal power, their dignity, their ability to project themselves and their Modi into the world is what mana is, right? And that's why our old people, the idea that they said to Hobson and Williams, yeah, we're going to seed or give you our mana for our people and place. Culturally, that's actually an impossible idea, Paul, because in our traditional worldview, that would have represented the epitome of a mana diminishing act.
Because you're giving it away.
You literally, they would have expected to die. That's why they fought so readily.
Wow.
When somebody actually acted in a mana diminishing way towards me, right? If I let that keep on happening, what they believed about their worldview was that their Modi would continue to diminish and they would die. That's why they responded so aggressively to protect their mana. Right? That's what mana means.
I get it. Can that overreact, though? I'm just trying to...
Absolutely.
You know, trying to see what...
Absolutely.
Bring the map together and see where we're all at. So, because that some people would say that, oh, you're so sensitive, always offended, you know, the mana thing. What do you say to that?
Well, look, I was taught by my old people, my mother, I was raised my mother, my dad had joined the Luftwaffe again by the time I was six. That's what she told me.
That was just a saying, right? It wasn't actually flying hindquarters or anything like that.
He left when I was six. I said, where'd dad go, Mum? And she said, oh, he's joined the Luftwaffe.
That's good sense of humour, got to say.
Yeah, well, yeah. Our people are like that, though. You know that.
Mm.
So anyway, so my mum and my old people taught me these things. Boy, they taught me to you know, tell the truth, you know, be good, say sorry fast, be respectful to everybody you meet, be fair, all that good stuff. But they also told me, Paul, was, but don't take any crap from anybody, right? Now, the reason for that is this mana question over generations is that if you let people deal to you, ultimately that results in your diminishment and potential extinction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you translate that into the contemporary setting to this very day. I'm a respectful person. I'll talk to anybody and I'll be positive and respectful. But the moment somebody is disrespectful to me in a way that is illegitimate, then then something else happens for me. Now, you may say, oh, that's a bit, you know, that's a bit prickly, or that's a bit, well, that's how you were raised.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, they're pretty similar principles all around, but that's, yeah, so don't put up with any crap.
Don't put up with any nonsense.
Or injustice. No. Is justice part of that? Injustice.
And injustice is one of those. You know, telling the truth and justice, you know, it's got to be at the foundation of any rules-based society, right? How do you say we live in a rules-based society where injustice and not telling and telling porkies is not illegitimate, right? So that
jumping to now, what do you think David Seymour and Axe's motives are in putting forward the Treaty Principles Bill, and we know the kind of rhetoric that comes from ACT. But what do you think? What do you think? What's it? What mission is he on?
Yeah, look, I think that's clear. I mean, I've spent a fair bit of time with David over the course of the year to listen carefully to him and understand what he's genuinely thinking. And I read a bit about it and asked him about it. So I've actually got a lot of personal time and sympathy for libertarian thought. So the ACT Party is, you know, ideologically, we'll call it that, has got a world view about what good looks like, and they're in pursuit of it. Now, that's an entirely legitimate thing to do, fair thing to do. That's what more or less we're all doing, right? Trying to do what we think's right. There is a little bit in there, though, that isn't principled, in my view. I think there is also a bit of populist politics playing the game.
Political relevance.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but we'll put that to side for a second. So I think that what ACT is doing is that they have an agenda, they have an ideology, they have a belief system that says to have an optimal liberal democracy with a highly performing market economy, this is what it looks like. And I don't have a problem with that essential proposition. Where we part company is some of what David and ACT is saying in their vision for New Zealand is ignoring what we've just been talking about in terms of our historical origins and what brings us to today. So they're either ignoring it or they're willfully manipulating and or disingenuously changing it in order to fit their vision of the go forward. The short version is, Our constitutional origins doesn't fit their vision. So they're using means fair and foul to negate those origins and create a go forward that fits their vision. That's what they're doing. And in order to execute on that, they need more than 8.6% of the population to support them. And so this is where the illegitimate or the dodgy bit comes in. What they're pursuing is a divisive, race-based, virtue signaling, you know, divide and conquer strategy to create among the uninformed, and let's face it, some of the bigoted, to get that 8.6% heading as far north as they can. That is exactly what they're doing, bud.
Okay. Lay out quickly, because we don't have that much time, and this is one hell of a question, a vision, because this is the thing that I think many people either don't give thought to or struggle with. If everyone is to be happy to the level of we can all march on and do more great things and make it all better, all those things.
Yeah.
How do we operate that system? I mean, what threshold? I don't want to say that you guys, because I don't want to think it of
aside. I know what you mean.
But, you know okay, the tide rises, lifts up all the boats. It's got to do that. But that's, you know, that can be difficult and it can take time. Yeah. What's your vision of how that could work, where everybody can just kick on, not be at each other, think that person's getting an advantage,
absolutely.
That person's
So I thought
not.
Hard about this. Thought hard about this. Quick version. First thing, our existing liberal democracy is a version one that we inherited from the 19th century, and it has so many significant flaws. We have the largest social and physical infrastructure deficit that we've ever seen. We have an adversarial political culture and that's incentivized to produce all of the wasteful nonsense that we see. And we have a huge inequity and despair that's got nothing to do with the treaty, nothing to do with married people. We have a version one democracy, which, Bud, is our number one priority, in my view, about looking clear eyes. We've got to change. We've got to improve it, right? Turkeys don't vote for Christmas, though, so that's got to come out of the community. First point. Second point, though, is that in that re-engineering of our liberal democracy to strengthen its cohesiveness and its effectiveness to bring about the changes we need economically and socially, We've got to honour our constitutional origins and the commitments that have been made that enable us to be here. And if we don't, you see, then we're doing violence to the idea that, in fact, this is a legitimate place to be, a rules-based society that is not based on justice and truth-telling. There's no legitimacy in it. So we've got to face that. We can't ignore it. So what does that look like? So I think for my money, I would pitch up three ideas. First off, at a practical level, the source of the greatest tension in our community is the inequity that is observable in our society, right? And all of the attempts and efforts being undertaken by the government at the moment and for decades are failing. In one fell swoop, here's how you can turn that around. In 1975, the federal government in the United States made a law that gave the opportunity to all Native American nations, they call them, who wanted to implement public policy in their community, the right and resources to do so, so that they had their own schools, their own hospitals, their own doctors, etc. Now, they did that and have created a transformative outcome. I would say if that similar opportunity was made available here in this land, within one generation, we would have closed the gap on the social inequality. And you wouldn't have to have spent another dollar because you'd fund it to the same degree. You'd simply make available, if they wanted it, to the tribal communities who are looking after these disproportionately burdened souls, you do it and take care of yourselves. So that's the first thing I'd do. The second thing I would say is that when it comes to a core source of aggravation in our community is the injustice associated with the treaty breaches, and in particular the property rights, the Whenua theft, right? So we've got a treaty settlement process that's been researched. We know what lands were taken. Settlements have been negotiated. Finish that off. Finish that off and complete it to a just outcome. And that then ticks that box and stops that aggravation constantly poking its head up. The last thing, and possibly the most challenging one, and this one is where there's a lot of ideas, but here would be my bid. The last one is, how do we get coexistent kāwanatanga or governance and rangatiratanga, tino rangatiratanga, which is tribal authority? How do those things live together?
Yeah,
one idea would be, in the 1950s, we had a bicameral parliament with an upper chamber that made provision for checks and balances on the unfettered execution of the government legislative agenda. That's what a lot of democracies have, bicameral houses.
Yeah.
What if, as an idea, we reintroduced an upper house that had in there elected representatives from the rangatiratanga sphere, elected representatives from the kāwanatanga sphere, and they acted in a deliberative mechanism in that upper house to, in effect, deliberate on the legislative program of the day, ensure that there was surfacing and appropriate discussion on the issues that are of concern in this land, and then away we went with the rest of our strengthened democracy. Now, if we implemented all three of those, as far as I can tell, the three articles of the treaty would be on it, and we would not have done violence to our democracy. I would argue we'd have strengthened it. So that would be my pitch to you and your listeners, Paul.
Okay, to some of what's just happened in the last few days, there was the haka in Parliament, the hikoi. What do you got to say about that haka? Doesn't bother me too much. I mean, people can perform and make a point and do their thing, and I think we're all big enough to handle just a little bit of it. And it's been interesting to see the reaction from other countries, but they don't know the nuances of New Zealand. I get that as well. So what would you say about what we saw there?
Well, I had spent quite a bit of time in the House watching the theatre of parliamentary questions and debate. You know, nobody answers questions. Well, I'm here to tell you, if anyone goes and sits in those things, they're mostly obfuscation, dodging and weaving and so forth. Theatre. What does parliamentary debate? There's no genuine engagement and substantive pushing them forward. They're just making points, trying not to lose. Theatre, that's how I'd characterise it. So, all right, there's the British version of the theatre of parliamentary process.
Yeah.
And on this particular topic, right, on this uniquely important constitutional topic, what, in my interpretation of what Hana Rāwhiti and the others who participated were saying was, to David and those supporting his bill, so you want to do violence to the first set of rules in this land, right, and negate them and ignore that? Well, to your rules in this house, here's what we think of that. That's how I interpret that. That was a reciprocation and a presentation of theatre from the Maori community, and of course it rocked everybody up and was from my perspective was enjoyable.
Certainly got cut through, Helmut, I'd say.
Yeah, well, that's what the theatre of on the parliamentary side tries to do, and yes, they did. They did get
well. That'd hold the record for views out of the entire history of Parliament. Probably.
I've heard some amazing numbers.
700 million.
That's phenomenal. I hadn't heard that one. Wow, that's out the gate.
Yeah, it sure is. On a world scale, that's
big. Yeah, that's something. Hikoi was its own story, though, bro.
We've seen the numbers quoted. I don't know what they are. It looked like a lot of people.
42 is the biggest. 42 is the biggest one I've heard.
Yeah, I've seen that too. I'm not here to talk about the numbers, except to say, what do you think those numbers represent about how New Zealanders are thinking and feeling? Because I think it's a legitimate question to ask. If you went up to anyone in that crowd, maybe a few would know, and asked specifically what their problem was, they probably couldn't give you too much of a specific answer. They'll give you a general one, but maybe not specific. And people will notice that. But what do you think it says about where New Zealand is? Because if we don't all sort of pull through together, alternatives aren't too flash, right?
We do. We will pull. Let me say this to you and your listeners. We will pull through this. So there's a generational divide on this issue. If you go and talk to pretty much anyone, sort of 40 or less, you can push it up a little bit older, right? They've grown up in an era where they're not vexed about Te Reo. They're not vexed about Te Tiriti or Waitangi. That's all passe type stuff, right? It's all us no-hair, grey hairs who are still, marginally vexed with the increased visibility of language we don't know, the increased visibility of people we still don't know what the hell they're talking about half the time, what they're advocating for. It's our generation that we're seeing. I'm interpreting this as being the final pendulum swing from an earlier era. But more importantly, though, what I would say about yesterday, as I stood there to speak and looked out over that vast blinging vista there, I saw faces that were obviously representative of a broad spectrum of New Zealanders. And the thought that came to me was, this is it. This is the vision for Aotearoa New Zealand. Tangata whenua, tangata tiriti, together, going forward, under the mana of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. So that really, for me, was the big takeaway from the day. It was a palpable and powerful, practical example of unity and action and rejection of the unilateral change in our history and rewriting of it. And the other last point was, it's given me great pleasure to see how around the world, other Kiwis, both Maori and non-Maori Kiwis around the world, have publicly stood and activated to say, hell no, no way. And so I'm very optimistic for our future, Paul. We just got to get us grey hair, no hairs out of the way in a little few years, and then she'll be right, bro.
All right. It's been really interesting chatting with you. Thanks for coming on our radio station. I think we've learned a lot, and it adds all sides of the story, right? It adds to the picture.
Absolutely.
So, Helmut Modlik, thank you for coming on RCR.
You're very welcome, and thank you for asking me. Kia ora, have a good day.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.